You're listening to Program to Chill, a show about business, crime, parapolitics, and esoterica with your host, Jimmy Falun Gong. This is Premium Episode 2, the Q&A Part 1, as it turns out, Coinage, Cash, and Silver. Today I'm recording from the Land of Oz. No, scratch that. I'm recording from Kansas. We gotta stay grounded here. Now, I know I'm speaking to you, dear listener, the elect, the premium subscriber, so you already know the score. You know what I'm talking about. And the questions I got for the Q&A were excellent. It was a lot of very meaty stuff. Still, due to an excess of modesty, I must put a disclaimer up. All I am is a man who's read a lot of books. Reading is my one true gift in life. It's the one thing I'm truly great at, right? And that's not to say I'm not at least decent at other things, but it's really only because I've read so much that I feel halfway justified in doing this show or giving my opinions on anything. And there are a lot of things I do not know. Consequently, if I'm asked about things that I don't know about, I will definitely let you know. But I will probably at least make a sporting attempt at linking it to something that I have read about, if it seems relevant. Also, in these Q&A episodes, I will probably do real-time citing of sources, rather than listing sources at the end of the episode. Just because I think I'm all over the place pulling from different sources, so I think that'll be helpful too. Also, sometimes I might be coy about certain things on the main Programmed to Chill free feed, right? But here, I'm not going to hold back or make insinuations. I will tell you what I really think. That's the Programmed to Chill premium show promise. Let's get into the questions. This question comes from Allie. Allie asks, "Hey Jimmy, super stoked for more content soon. My question is about the coin shortage in the United States. I've heard a few people say that it's intentional to usher in a cashless society. Do you think there's any truth to this? Also, do you know of or have any other theories about the coin shortage?" That's a great question. The short answer is yes. I do think that they are going to get rid of physical cash. I think there is a long-term plan to do that. Now, I am not a hardline New World Order type of guy, and most of the people I've seen on the conspiratorial side of things who talk about this are kind of right-wing New World Order types. However, I do think the long-term plan is to eliminate cash. I also think that the American dollar will eventually be replaced. And with the way that the financial elites operate, it will probably be a surprise controlled demolition of the US dollar, leaving everyone holding the bag. Now the thing is, at least for eliminating cash, this is not exactly fringe tinfoil hat territory, at least not in the good year of 2021. If you were talking about this in the 80s, maybe it would have sounded kookier. But Klaus Schwab, who runs the World Economic Forum, wrote a book called COVID, The Great Reset. I know a lot of people are talking about this. The book came out in July 2020. In the book, there's a chapter called The Fate of the US Dollar, and it speculates along the same lines, speculating both that cash might eventually be eliminated and that the US dollar, you know, might no longer be as important as it once was, and currently is. There is also some favorable discussion in the book of China experimenting with digital currencies. Now, being a public-facing document, this book does not divulge any plans. It's more like analysis, right? But, you know. Now, I think there is reason to be concerned if you're living in the United States and you're anything less than a billionaire. And also, the Great Reset is not the only thing discussing the end of cash. Ray Dalio, the billionaire, he's the 78th richest person in the world, supposedly. He's a famous investor, and he's the operator of the largest hedge fund in the world, Bridgewater Associates. Ray Dalio has said, "Cash is trash." In the same remarks, he warned against investing in Bitcoin. Now, I'm not really like a money guy, right? I'm certainly not a crypto guy. I've never owned any crypto. I'm not going to. But I think that when whales like Ray Dalio speak publicly about their investments, I don't necessarily think that they're telling you what they are doing, right? They might, but they might not. I suspect that he's probably telling the truth about cash, but not about Bitcoin. I'm pretty agnostic on Bitcoin, and that's more due to my personal disposition, not, like, if I had to try to guess the mechanism by which wealth will be stored in the future, maybe I would pick Bitcoin. But for a much better discussion of it than I could ever give, check out the Farms episode, The Secret History of Cryptocurrency, which has some very interesting history and speculation about where crypto is headed. Now, I think it'd be interesting to talk a little bit about cash itself. Cash has a lot of purposes, but what is its role on the black market? Obviously, it's anonymous, it's relatively easy to surreptitiously move around. Obviously, there's a volume limitation there, but overall, crime, organized crime, loves cash, right? No paper trail for the most part. There's a lot of reasons why cash is important in the underground economy. This all makes sense, right? I'm not breaking new ground. But cash does a lot more than just this. Now I pull a quote from a book called Reefer Madness, Sex, Drugs, and Cheap Labor in the American Black Market. The supremacy of the dollar in the global underground has proven a boon to the American economy. The outflow of U.S. currency now serves, in essence, as a gigantic interest-free loan. Every time the U.S. Treasury issues new banknotes, it purchases an equal amount of interest-bearing securities. Those securities are liquidated only when the currency is taken out of circulation and put into a bank. In the year 2000, the U.S. Treasury estimated a $32.7 billion in interest from its banknotes circulating overseas. Now, this is pretty nuts. Basically, outflows of U.S. currency serve as interest-free loans, essentially. This is one reason why I don't think cash will go away not as quickly as we might think. This is also why I think that the war on drugs, which of course is a sham for many reasons, is extra hypocritical, because it's in the interest of the U.S. Treasury that the black market use U.S. currency. Now, regarding this specific coin shortage, I'm not really so sure that it, in and of itself, is part of any larger plot. There were previous coin shortages, by the way. I kind of remember one or two within the past decade, but of course there was a big coin shortage from like starting in 1959 to 1965. The coin shortage led to the Coinage Act of 1966. Those shortages were all about silver, which silver in general is such an interesting, weird part of American life, because you know how gold bugs are usually like right-wing weirdos, which no disrespect to any of you dear listeners if that applies to you, but you know how gold bugs and gold standard people often have some pretty unorthodox views, some of which are right, some of which are wrong, right, or debatable anyway, but silverites, which is the term that they use to contrast with gold bugs, silverites are much less discussed. For a lot of good reasons. There aren't really silverites anymore, for one thing, but silverites were a major political force in the United States. Silverites go back to the period of bimetallism. Bimetallism is when you peg a currency not just to gold or just to silver, but to both. Bimetallism, right? And it goes back a long way. Different countries have done bimetallism, but America has used it before, and there were interesting things going on with Alexander Hamilton with silver, but I'm not going to go into that, it was too long ago. But as a halfway modern political force, bimetallism and silver really goes back to the Civil War, and that's when the United States went off of bimetallism in order to switch to fiat currency, and they did that in order to finance the war. Now, the thing is, farmers and Western interests, they both loved fiat currency, which was still backed by silver. It was just more floating and it wasn't quite as fixed as like a hard gold standard. and these farmers and these Western interests formed the short-lived Greenback Party to push this agenda. At the same time, there arose a free silver movement, which overlapped with early modern forms of populism. The free silver people opposed the gold standard, which pegged currency at a more stable but therefore less flexible rate. Basically, this is economic-based stuff. People from different classes with different economic interests fighting over monetary policy. Which, by the way, is crazy because nowadays, very few people except cranks make monetary policy a primary issue. Kind of shows, to an extent, the degeneration of democracy in the United States, if you ask me. So, the free silver movement sort of floated above party boundaries, kind of overlapping them, but for the most part it was associated with Democrats as well as unions. Although there was a silver Republican Party, which is fun, which, I mean, that's arguably more of a faction, but still. William Jennings Bryan, who was a Democrat who supported free silver, he ran for president against the Republican William McKinley, who supported the gold standard. Surely unrelated to anything, William McKinley was assassinated in 1901. So William McKinley and the Republicans made as one of their core issues the defense of sound money, which is to say the gold standard, because that is central to international trade. William Jennings Bryan was the eloquent champion of the cause, and he gave a famous Cross of Gold speech at the National Democratic Convention. This was in 1896. He said, "The gold standard has slain tens of thousands." He spoke about a struggle between the idle holders of idle capital and the struggling masses who produce the wealth and pay the taxes of the country. And he said, "My friends, the question we are to decide is, upon which side will the Democratic Party fight?" He said, "You shall not press down upon the brow of labor this crown of thorns. You shall not crucify mankind upon a cross of gold." Which is just like, so over the top. But imagine, U.S. democracy arguing about monetary policy. You can't even imagine it anymore. So William Jennings Bryan lost for a lot of reasons, not least of which because they discovered the cyanide process, which let gold be extracted from lower grade ore. The thing is, the free silver people were actually pretty wild and interesting, and to a lesser extent, they were sort of proto-socialists, and they had accompanying secret societies even. There were several silverite fraternal orders, like the Freeman's Protective Silver Federation. They had all the trappings of a fraternal order, including rituals, grips, passwords, and so on. It was a lot of Masonic stuff, in other words, but in a totally different context. For this federation, they banned any bankers or lawyers from joining, which is pretty funny. There was also the Silver Knights of America, which was almost more of a proto-lobbying group in Washington, D.C. There was the Patriots of America, which tried to get elected officials to swear an oath, refusing to have property of over $100,000. All pretty interesting ideas, right? That's why when we talk about the United States and the way things developed, it never had to be like this. At every juncture, there were always opportunities for things to have been better. Now, the free silver movement became more and more tied to populism, unions, and ordinary Americans fighting against the banks, railroad monopolists, and robber barons. The silk toppers, in other words. Silver was to be the people's money, as opposed to the gold-based currency, which was portrayed by the populists as the money of exploitation and oppression. And mind you, none of this is really fringe stuff. This was the normal political discourse at the time. It's crazy, right? But was this an op? Was this sus? Or at least were there malignant elements to the free silver movement? Some people think there were. The progressive activist Henry Demarest Lloyd held a harshly critical view of the free silver movement. He said, The Free Silver Movement is a fake. Free Silver is the cowbird of the reform movement. It waited until the nest had been built by the sacrifices and labor of others, and then it lay its own eggs in it, pushing out the others which lie smashed on the floor. Which I can see how taking all of the effort and time away from unions and other reform movements and trying to pass legislation to make silver the monetary policy would certainly have the potential of being kind of a bait and switch, I guess you could say. Great ideas, perhaps flawed execution. But historians more trained than me, historians more dedicated than me could probably explain this better. I am simply an observer. I can't pass judgment here on the tactical and strategic errors of the past. Here's the thing, though. So you know The Wizard of Oz? The classic movie and the series of books, right? And technically there's a whole, like, extended universe with, like, lore and stuff, right? So L. Frank Baum wrote The Wizard of Oz, and he did it. He wrote it as an extended political allegory about the gold and silver debates of the time. In fact, the story kind of becomes hilarious when you break down each part. The yellow brick road is the gold standard. The silver shoes, which became ruby slippers in the 1939 film version, probably to show off, you know, Technicolor or whatever. The silver shoes represent the silverite 16-to-1 silver ratio, which was supposed to be in place for the currency. The city of Oz is named, of course, because of the abbreviation of ounces, O-Z, in which gold and silver are both measured. Now, this interpretation has been challenged, and more on that in a little bit, but Hugh Rockoff, which is a great name, Hugh Rockoff, the University of Chicago economist, has also written that the novel was an allegory about the demonetization of silver, and he wrote that the cyclone which carried Dorothy to the Land of Oz represented the economic and political upheaval. The yellow brick road stands for the gold standard, and the silver shoes that Dorothy inherits from the Wicked Witch of the East represent the pro-silver movement. When Dorothy is taken to the Emerald Palace before her audience with the wizard, she is led through 7 passages and up 3 flights of stairs, which is a subtle reference to the Coinage Act of 1873, which started class conflict in America. Of course, class conflict did not start in 1873, but certainly it ignited in 1873, so that's fine. According to this interpretation, the scarecrow represented the American farmers and their troubles in the 19th century. The Tin Man represented the industrial workers, especially that of U.S. Steel, of American Steel. And, get this, the Cowardly Lion was representing William Jennings Bryan. The cyclone, or tornado, represented the possibility of political revolution in the 1890s, which could have transformed the country into a land of color and unlimited prosperity. It was very common at the time to depict political upheaval as a tornado in political cartoons, right? Dorothy was supposed to represent the goodness and innocence of humanity. And, you know, you can keep going with this, right? So the Wicked Witch of the East is supposed to be a metaphor for the American West. And some of these sound strained, but there is still textual evidence, like the winged monkeys were supposed to represent Native Americans. I'm not saying that this is good, right? But, you know. And the king of the winged monkeys, in case this sounds like a stretch, in the text, he tells Dorothy, "Once we were a free people, living happily in the great forest, flying from tree to tree, eating nuts and fruit and doing just as we pleased, without calling anybody master. This was many years ago, long before Oz came out of the clouds to rule over this island." So you see that, you know, with each of these things, kind of sounds absurd, but there is evidence for it. But who was L. Frank Baum? He was a Republican political activist who had some rather interesting ideas. Obviously, he was also an author in later years. Now, he was a gold bug. He also had some pretty repugnant settler colonial views. He wrote an editorial in 1890 for his newspaper, The Saturday Pioneer, and I'll quote from it here. "The whites, by law of conquest, by justice of civilization, are the masters of the American continent, and the best safety for the frontier settlements will be secured by the total annihilation of the few remaining Indians. Why not annihilation?" Now, some people have argued that he was being sarcastic, but it is not at all obvious or clear that he was. And given the time and place and the actions going on, I don't really buy that he was being sarcastic. Now, in his personal life, L. Frank Baum was raised Methodist. He then became an Episcopalian, but because he was involved in the theater, he got involved with the Theosophical Society. Now, I would probably never finish this episode if I do a full discussion of theosophy, and I do have episodes planned in the future, hopefully, to cover theosophy, but a short version is that it's a New Age spiritual movement. I say New Age, it's not like 1960s. It became big in the 1960s, but it predates that by several decades. It's a New Age spiritual movement that grew out of spiritualism. It comes primarily from a woman named Madame Blavatsky, who is a Russian immigrant to the United States. Theosophy sort of fuses occult tradition with Neoplatonism and Buddhism. The single most recognizable belief, theosophical belief, is the belief in ascended masters, or a secret, occluded group of spiritual leaders, often in Tibet and elsewhere, who try to guide humanity's spiritual progress. Now, other literary critics have also pointed out that The Wizard of Oz is full of allegories and symbolism that also get across the spiritual teachings of theosophy. One critic has written that Dorothy's experiences in Oz represent the soul's journey towards enlightenment. For example, the yellow brick road is also kind of reminiscent of the golden path in Buddhism, along which the soul travels to a state of spiritual realization, right? L. Frank Baum was definitely aware of Buddhism at quite an early date, if you think about it, through this connection to theosophy. And I must say that these two readings of The Wizard of Oz and the Oz series don't necessarily cancel each other out. You know, just like how good art can be doing a lot of things at the same time, I think that you can argue that there was pretty likely that Baum was drawing some political conclusions, and it's entirely possible that he was also interjecting the story with theosophical ideas. And obviously it's a very popular, you know, the movie is extremely popular, so there's something there that really resonates with people. There's almost like Jungian, you know, archetypes going on with the characters. Like, it really works on a certain level. So I don't think it's crazy to say that both of these readings can be correct. Now, Baum also wrote a series of girl sleuth books called the Bluebird books. Now, the title consciously evokes the Bluebird, which is a recurring concept or meme, I guess you could say, of the Bluebird as the harbinger of happiness. And you see this symbol or, you know, meme recur throughout many works, probably most prominently in Maurice Maeterlinck's The Bluebird, which is a symbolist play that went far in winning Maeterlinck the Nobel Prize in Literature in 1911. Being a symbolist author, Maeterlinck was very interested in the occult, and it has been asserted that the CIA was thinking about and referring to the Bluebird play by Maeterlinck when they created Project Bluebird, which was a mind control project predating MKUltra and later rolled into it. Now, the CIA Project Bluebird experimented with LSD, but not only LSD, also sensory deprivation, electroshock therapy, electrode brain implants, and hypnosis, with an eye to creating amnesia, depersonalization, changes in identity, and altered states of consciousness. Memory, in particular, is a was a key facet of the human experience that they were studying under Bluebird and Artichoke, both of which became MKUltra. Not a coincidence, the Bluebird play by Maeterlinck focuses quite a bit on memory. Switching gears a little bit, for what it's worth, Kenneth Anger, the experimental filmmaker with pagan and satanic interests, he was raised on the Wizard of Oz books, and his biographer wrote that the Wizard of Oz books laid the groundwork for Kenneth Anger's attraction to Aleister Crowley, who is the occultist who would rework Rosicrucian thought into his own magical system. Bobby Bolizol, one of the Manson family murderers, was in a band called the Magic Powerhouse of Oz. The Wizard of Oz has been cited as one of the movies most associated with the controversial Project Monarch stuff. I say controversial because I have not seen definitive proof that it even exists, though it could. The three movies that are most frequently cited as being part of this brainwashing are The Wizard of Oz, Fantasia, and Alice in Wonderland. Disney Studios, of course, made two of those three, and Disney wanted to buy up the rights to The Wizard of Oz. They didn't get the chance. I think MGM got the rights to it. But Disney bought the rights to all the other bomb books in the Wizard of Oz series, and Disney did produce Wizard of Oz movies. To that end, in 1957, Disney Studios created an unreleased film called The Rainbow Road to Oz, and the public was able to see a preview of it, and it is not clear why the film was never released. I'm not implying anything, it's curious, right? And then, in 1985, Disney made a very curious film called The Return to Oz. In this movie, Dorothy, the character from the original Wizard of Oz, she returns to Kansas, right? And she is now thought to be crazy because she talks about this land, the Land of Oz. She gets warned by her friends and family not to talk about Oz, and she keeps doing it, so they take her to a psychologist who wears a big ruby ring. This psychologist tells her that electroshock will not harm her. He also says a curious line that we are at the dawn of a new age. He tells her that memories are just dreams that stem from excess electrical current in the brain. Then she is sent to a mental institute to receive shock treatments for talking about the Land of Oz. In the course of the movie, there's a lot of trippy, creepy imagery with mirrors, and the film's climax involves Dorothy meeting her twin, who is kept as a slave by the Princess of Oz. I'll read from a portion of the screenplay here. Dorothy gazed at herself in the mirror, seeing her own reflection, and remembering the moment when she had looked at herself and seen someone else there, someone so like her that it could have been her sister. Now, for whatever reason, portions of this film were shot near Stonehenge, and they brought in a character from the series who is known as TikTok, just like the app, right? Now, you tell me that there are not some very dark vibrations and very, very curious plot choices coming off of this film, knowing what we know about these things. I mean, this was a major motion picture. This was like a normal movie that Disney put out, right? Very, very curious. Oh, and what did Baum think of his own writing? He believed that The Wizard of Oz may have been divinely inspired. He said, "It was pure inspiration. It came to me right out of the blue. I think that sometimes the great author had a message to get across, and he was to use the instrument at hand." Very curious. Oh, and to take it back to William Jennings Bryan, the preeminent Free Silver presidential candidate, he had a great grandson named William Joseph Bryan. William Joseph Bryan was a physician and leading hypnotist. He worked on Project Artichoke and MKUltra. Specifically, he worked on a research project into behavioral engineering of humans, and he worked on what he called hypno-conditioning. Now, of almost all the doctors involved with MKUltra, we might actually know the most about William Joseph Bryan, which is curious. Dr. Bryan induced Albert DeSalvo's confession as the Boston Strangler. He did it through hypnosis, and there are a lot of questions about that. Dr. Bryan was also an expert witness at Sirhan Sirhan's trial for shooting Robert F. Kennedy. I quote here from the book, A Lie Too Big to Fail, The Real History of the Assassination of Robert F. Kennedy. Only one hypnotist besides the defense and prosecution experts ever claimed to have hypnotized Sirhan, Dr. William J. Bryan. According to Bill Turner and John Christian, two prostitutes who serviced Bryan regularly said he liked to talk about his famous clients, and he had mentioned Sirhan Sirhan. They assumed that he meant he hypnotized Sirhan after the assassination, but Dr. Bryan did not have access to Sirhan Sirhan after the assassination. If he hypnotized him at all, it would have been before the shooting, not after. Unquote. Now, mind you, Sirhan Sirhan got pretty deep into Rosicrucianism in his time before the assassination, Rosicrucianism having occult connections to Theosophy. They're not the same, but there's some overlap there. Dr. Bryan talked about Henry Bush, the so-called Hollywood Strangler. Dr. Bryan stated that the Hollywood Strangler was programmed very definitely, and he discussed how he hypnotized him to determine the Hollywood Strangler's motive. Henry Bush, the Hollywood Strangler, had been a Korean War veteran, and he was working in an optical firm when he was arrested as a purse snatcher. But then he broke down suddenly and started babbling to police of strangling three women. Dr. Bryan was also called to testify at the Manson family trial of Linda Kasabian, who was in the Manson family. Right around this time, Dr. Bryan was placed on probation by the California State Board of Medical Examiners after having been found guilty of having sexual relations with four women he had hypnotized. The book Programmed to Kill, The Politics of Serial Murder says, Dr. Bryan was also linked to Candy Jones, the famous model who told her tale of being a mind-controlled courier and possibly assassin as well, in the book The Control of Candy Jones. Not long after the publication of the book, Dr. Bryan was tied to the Candy Jones case by journalists investigating Candy Jones's claims. Dr. Bryan soon thereafter turned up dead in a Las Vegas hotel room. Dr. Bryan died in 1977, the year that the House Select Committee on Assassinations was formed to investigate the John F. Kennedy and Martin Luther King assassinations. Dr. Bryan also had links to Arthur Bremer's assassination attempt against Henry Wallace. Now, it could be nothing that William Joseph Bryan is the great-grandson of the most famous Silverite, or it could be something. Just remember, William McKinley was assassinated. Makes you think. Is there a conspiracy of Silverites throughout history? Or is there something else going on? And if so, what is it? I'm not being coy, I don't know. Either way, you decide. So, I've wandered very far afield from the original question, but I'm assuming that's what you're here for, so hopefully this was a good answer. Thank you for listening, dear listener. You already know about the Patreon, obviously, so just let people know about the show. And again, I appreciate you subscribing. Now I need to be on my way. I'll see you next episode, and God bless.